We're here on Lamed Ches Amud Beis. So let's just quickly review the last thing that we spoke about. And the question was, do we apply Kimlei V'Ravine in the case of Knas? So we had the sheet of Rava, which we've had earlier in the Perek, called Chidushu Shechidsha Torah B'Knas, that Knas is a Chidush, and Afal Gav D'Miktal Mishalim, and that's going to touch on the two versions of Rabbi Akiva. We have Rabbi Akiva in the Mishnah, and we have Rabbi Akiva in the Braisa. So according to the version of Rabbi Akiva in the Mishnah, in the case of Nisarso and Nisgarsho, she collects the knas. In the case of Rabbi Akiva in the Braisa, then in Nisarso and Nisgarsho, the father collects the knas, meaning his rights to the knas are not removed. Those were the two nuschos in Rabbi Akiva. So the Gemara here asks, according to Rabba, who says that Kimei Rabbi doesn't apply to knas, is then my equal and Meimar. How is he going to explain Rabbi Akiva in the Braisa? Because according to Rabbi Akiva in the Braisa, we have Rabbi Akiva in the Mishnah. Let's go over that. He has the Pasuk Asher Lo Orosa, and that's going to teach me that if she was Orosa, then the Knas goes to the Isha herself, right? She collects her own Knas, as if to say that with Erusin she leaves the Rishus of her father, such that if there's Gerushin, she doesn't go back into the Rishus of her father, and therefore she collects the Knas. That's Rabbi Akiva in the Mishnah. But as far as Rabbi Akiva in the Brais is concerned, he's not going to be able to say that the meaning of the Pasuk is to exclude Arusa from Knas, because Rabbi Akiva in the Brais holds that there is a Chiv Knas, despite the fact that there's Misa. And that, if you recall, was based on a drasha. Let's go with the drasha again, and then we'll pick up where we left off on Daf Lavaches Amud Beis. The drasha of Rabbi Akiva in the Braisa was the following: that he takes Asher Lo Orosa out of the simple pshat of the pasuk and he uses it for Gzeirah Shavah. And that's the Braisa here on Lamaches Amud Aleph, Asher Lo Rasa. And Rabbi Akiva says, Yesh Lo Knas U'Knas Alaviya. U'Knas Alaviya. And he has a logical analysis based on the fact that the father still gets, even if he marries her off a second time when she's an Ara, he collects the Kesef Kiddushin. So what do we do with Asher Lo Rasa? And he uses it for Gzeirah Shavah. The Gemara then goes into, if you recall, a whole analysis. Why does he choose to use Asher Lo Rasa as Gzeirah Shavah? He could have chosen Besula, Nara. All the others he insists are an absolute condition. But here, he uses it as Gzeirah Shavah. And the Gemara wants to say that Rabbi Akiva in the Mishnah has one up it, so to speak, on Rabbi Akiva in the Braisa, because we still get something out of the Pashtei Dekra, if you remember, the simple pshat in the pasuk.
Of this phrase we mean.
Of Asher Lo Rasa. In other words, that Asher Lo Rasa should be understood in its context to tell you that the father doesn't collect the knas. But according to Rabbi Akiva in the Braisa, the Gemara was hard-pressed to know what do we gain from what does the pasuk mean within its own context in Pshuto Shel Mikra when it says Asher Lo Rasa, because through the Gzeirah Shavah we're taking it completely out of context.
You know, it's if they're no longer words, they're just pointers now. hey, look over here, hey, look over here, and right. Tie them together.
But it's very strange that, yeah. You know, the din of knas doesn't change one iota with erisin. You know, it remains where it is, and the father continues to collect the knas. So the Gemara quoted a statement of Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, and he says, "Karibe asher lo orasa." In other words, that she wasn't married at the time of the ones. So the Gemara has a havamina here, which is going to collide with or contradict Rabbah. That I shouldn't say that. I should say the havamina actually reflects the Shita Rabbah. But the maskana here of Ashalo Rasa is going to undermine the Shita of Rabbah, because the havamina was that maybe she would get knas, even though she's still in Arusa, and he's going to be put to death. So the final maskana is that if she is an Arusa, if she had been an Arusa at the time of the onus, then there would be no knas, and that's against Rabbah. Fine. So now what we're up to is Amar Abaye. That's where we start. We start the new week with Amar Abaye. Let's see if we can find the place here. Amar Abaye, it's about six lines up before the end of the Amud. So we're on Lamed Ches Amud Beis, five, 6 lines up from the bottom, and Amar Abaye. Ba'alea u'mesa.
Wait a minute.
You don't have
to explain Rabbah, but then we have a time of Rabbanan, Knasim, and me.
Yeah, I'm skipping that. If you want, we can go over that, but that was we did last week.
Okay, sorry.
It's just a technicality that there are 2 days in the Brice, and the Gemara says that's Machlok Shin, the two versions of Rabbi. Okay. So Ba'alei u'Mesa, that's the topic for the new week. So she wasn't alive at the time of what's called Hamad Bedin. We know what Hamad Bedin is, yeah?
Right.
Okay. So now, Abai says, I have a drasha to establish that in this case, the Ma'anes is not going to be Chai for Knas, Potter. Shenemar, because in the Parsha Monas it says, V'nasan, I'll read the whole pasuk, V'nasan ha'ish ha'shochev ima la'avi ha'nara chamishim kosef. Now, Abai is about to darshan the meaning or derive from these two words, la via nara, a certain conclusion. So I just want to mention here at the outset, because it's going to come in very handy later on, that there are two approaches to understand the drush of Abai. One approach is the simple approach, that the Torah is telling you that you pay knas to the father, which to the father of the Nara. And the implication is that she's alive. That's going to be the drasha of Lo Avi Mesa. I'll get to that in a second. But I just want to point out to you, because again, I think if we keep it in our back pocket, it may pay to pull it out at some point, that there's also another way of darshaning this, of understanding this drasha of Abai, and that is that the Torah could have completely omitted the word hanara. It could have said liaviha, because earlier in the parasha it mentions that he had this relationship with a nara. So why does it have to say v'nasan ha'ish ha'shochevi malaviha nara? And that, again, keep that in mind, because it may help us later on. Now, let's emphasize the word potur in this case. Why do I emphasize the word potur? If not for the word potur, we could have had Abai's drasha in a whole different way. We could have said the following. that when does he pay the knas to the father? That's only if she's alive. And then the father, in a sense, represents her. I mean, she was the victim of this crime, but she doesn't collect the knas because she has a father. So the father replaces her, but that's only because she's alive. Now, that's wrong. Why is that wrong? Because of the word patur. And I'll tell you what I mean. If the exclusion of Abaye is only based on the fact that the father can only represent her to be tovet, to collect the knas, because she's alive, but really there is a knas, then if she has relatives and the father is amongst her relatives, they can inherit her. That's called Yerusha. In other words, leave out the word potter for just 1 second, and we'll come back to the word potter. Yesh lachar. There are two ways of understanding this pasuk, v'nasan lo isha shochev imo la'via na'ara, meaning that she's alive. One way is to say that what the Torah is telling us is that if she dies, then the knas is completely removed. In other words, there's no tvia, there's no claim. When we get to Bezdin and the father wants to sue the ma'anes for damages, you know, for knas, he has no right to sue him at all. The other way of learning it is that he doesn't have a right to sue her because...
To sue him,
because since she died, therefore all her rights are inherited, are passed on through the kever, in other words, after death, to other people. Who are those other people? So again, we'd have to learn Yesh Nochlin for this, but the Gemara is going to have the possibility that she has a child. Don't ask me any questions now. We're going to spend an hour on that to try to figure out how could she possibly have a child. But let's just assume that she could possibly have a child. If you'll grant me that, which is coming up in the next two lines in the Gemara, then what happens is the following. If you have a grandfather, a son, and a grandson, if the son dies, then his Yerusha goes to his son, the grandson, rather than to his father. In other words, the father is secondary to the son. The closest relative, as far as an heir is concerned, is the son. So let's say, in a theoretical world, she has a son, and she died. All her rights now are passed on to her son, not to her father.
Right.
Because her son comes first in the Seder HaYerusha before her father. So in the second interpretation that I'm offering in Abaye, the reason why the Torah is excluding Avia Mesa is to tell you that he doesn't have rights. There may be someone who has rights to take over her rights. Because the problem is that once she dies, she takes her rights to collect knas down to her grave. And those rights now have to be bequeathed through the parasha of Yerusha to someone. And it could be that when the Torah is excluding Avia Nara, it means because she has an heir that comes before her father. But that pshat is incorrect. Why is it incorrect? Because the Torah used the word, because the Gemara used the word potter. The word potter means not that we're trying to juggle who has the rights to collect these funds, you know, that are coming to her because she's already dead, but rather that the knas is potter, the onus is potter. He doesn't pay knas. So we'll clarify this as we go along, but please keep in mind that what Abaye is saying, he's going very far. He's saying something about knas. He's saying that the Torah makes a condition in knas that the Nara before Haman Abedin is alive. If she's not alive, then the whole enterprise of knas is completely removed. It's not a question of knocking off the father because he's not the first heir, but rather we're going to undermine the knas itself. And that's the word potter. So I'm just giving you a clue, a kind of preview of coming attractions of what's coming up in this sugya. because if not for Abaye, we could have understood that the Torah, when it says Lavia Naro, which means Velo Avia Mesa, is only excluding the father as the Yoresh, because there's a prior Yoresh who gets priority. Now you may ask me the following question: well, if she died before Hamon of Edin, how could she have any rights? And usually we assume that Hamon of Edin generates the rights, because we need again, I'm not going to go into all the complicated details here, but we need a Bezdin in order to paskin that there's a Knas. Without a Bezdin, there is no Knas. But this is a Mishnah later on. The next Mishnah we're going to have is about a Bogeris. And the Gemara is going to tell us that if she was a Nara at the time of the Onus, and then she became a Bogeris at the time of Hamad Abedin, so you have time T1, which is the time of the Onus, and she's a Nara, and time T2, in this case, which is Hamad Abedin, she's already a Bogeris. She has Simoni Bagur, she's already 12 and a half plus a day, and so forth and so on. So the Mishnah is going to establish that in such a case, she collects the Knas.
But you know, there's something I don't understand here. You're talking about that the chiyuv only starts when there's a pasak din. But earlier, when we were talking about timing and whether the ganeva occurred at the same time as Kiddush Shabbat, we're talking about the time maaseh, not the time of pasak.
Excellent question, Chaim. But that's because there's a machayev and there's a chiyuv. In other words, after Bezdin, in Hamad Abedin, will issue a verdict to the effect that he has to pay knas, then he's paying knas for the maisa vera of the onus itself. And if at that moment of the maisa vera he incurred a chiyuv misa, then that maisa is not machat. So Bezdin cannot possibly issue a ruling that he has to pay knas.
So it's almost like it's retroactive. In other words, he's not really...
I would say it's conditional, not retroactive. What I mean to say is that the machayev is the maisa onus as an avera, but it's conditional on the fact that there will be Hamad Abedin, that Bezdin will go through the entire process, they'll induce Edim, and they'll issue a final ruling. All those are technicalities, but if you ask me where's the Avera HaMechayeves, the answer is it's the Bia itself, it's the onus itself.
Thank you.
So as far as Kim Lev and Rami Ney, we're going to go back to the Maisa Machayev, the Avera Machayevis. I'm going to see if that coincides with some sort of Chiv Misa, let's say in the case of Baal Bito. But as far as the Chiv per se, that Chiv will only be established and will only emerge after Hamad Abedin. But yet, there are what's called Zchuyot. You know, that in Dini Momentus, in monetary law, there are two stages. There's one called the schus, which means I have rights to collect. And then there's the chiv itself. It's in certain cases, like in case of a knas, the chiv starts at one moment. I'm sorry, the schus emerges at one moment, but the chiv only emerges later. And why do I say this? Because in the case of a bogeres, she's going to collect the knas. Now, if the onus took place when she was a bogeres, there would be no knas. So you and I would say, well, how could Bezdin establish a chiv knas when she's a bogeres? The answer is because the onus took place when she was a nara, and that onus when she was a nara generates a schus which she can collect as a bogeres. On the contrary, her schuyot in a sense are upgraded when she becomes a bogeres, because if the hamad abedin took place before she became a bogeres, who's going to be tovei and collect the knas? Her father. But once she's a bogeres, she leaves the rishus of her father. It's no longer been rebbe savia, and now she collects the knas. So in a funny sort of sense, you know, those chuyot that exist, and they were generated by the Maisonis, now they're upgraded as far as she's concerned. She now sits in the driver's seat when she becomes a Bogeris. In a similar case, if not for Abaye, what we would have said was that if she dies before the Hamad Abedin, then all her chuyot now are transferred over to her heirs. And let's say she has a son. Again, we're going to spend a long time trying to figure out how could she possibly have a son. So don't ask me any questions about that. That's going to be an hour's discussion. The Gemara is going to do somersaults in the end to try to figure out how she could have a son. But if she has a son, then her son will be Tovea the Knas. And that could be another way of learning the pasuk. This is not Abaye. Again, I emphasize this for a million times over. This is not Abaye. But if not for Abaye, we could have said that when the Torah says, V'nasan, etc., La Via Narah, as opposed to a mesa, what the Torah is doing is it's knocking off the father. Why? Because those chuyot that are engendered by the maisa onus are passed on to her son if she has a son, rather than her father, because he's not next in line, he doesn't get priority in Yerusha. But that's not Abaye, because Abaye says potter. Abaye is telling you that what he sees in this parasha is that the Torah says that if she dies between the onus and the hamad bedin, the knas is completely gone. Not that it transfers over to her yorshim. Which is fascinating when you think about it, because it really undermines everything we've been saying. Because what we said in the case of Bogeres is that the rights that she has from the time that she was a Nara are, so to speak, frozen, and then they can be collectible when she becomes a Bogeres, and Faket, she collects it herself in Amon Abedin. But here what we're saying, Koy Tabai, is that if she dies between the onus and the Hamad of Adin, then those rights are completely undermined, completely null and void.
Does it say the same with Kefil and Dalveh? I mean, because it's the same concept. It's Kenas that he's
again, the answer is that Abai is based on Xeris HaKosov. You know, it's even Abai understands that logically, since those Chuyot emerged, she should be able to collect the Kenas, and if not her Yorshim, at the time Hamad of Adin. But the Torah went out of its way, and here's where I told you there's another way for learning Abai's Yorshim, and the word Hanara is an extra word. And that's coming to teach me that the Knas is completely undermined. But that's only in this case with Xavier Sarkozy.
In the case of Kefil and Dal Dehay, everybody would agree if it was before Hamad of Adin.
So that's a gigantic machlokas, whether there's Yerushal Knas or not. I'm assuming now, like that Mandiomar that says there is Yerushal Knas. Yeah. Now, if you're going to go with the Mandiomar that there's no Yerushal Knas, then in a case where the Nignav died before they were able to be Tovea the Knas, then he cannot, the Nignav cannot pass on and transfer his rights to collect the Knas after his death through Yerusha, then the Yorish will only be able to collect the Keren and not the Knas. So right now we're going to assume that there is Yerusha on Knas. Okay, the next line in the Gemara is very, very crucial. And I have to tell you up front, I spent a lot of time in this. This line in the Gemara is not to be understood in its context, if you follow what I mean. The Gemara says the following: that which was simple to Abaye was a question to Rava. And then it says in the next two words, Deboi Rava. But you have to be very patient here, because the Deboi Rava that we're about to see now is not what the Gemara has in mind. It's going to be another interpretation of Rava, not this one. Mm. So let me just explain to you that what we're saying is that the Deboi Rava that we're about to embark upon is completely antithetical to Abaye. The Gemara is saying that Rava vacillated back and forth about Abaye, and we're going to only understand that when we get to the Gemara on Daf Lamentesam and Aleph of what's his name of Mar Bar Avashi. Okay, so keep in mind that what we just read now, Milsa de Pshita Leil Abaye Miboy Leil Rava, is only going to make sense according to Mar Bar Avashi, which is coming on Daf Lamentes. You know, so it took me hours to figure this out. It's very strange, because the way the, you know, when Ravina Ravashi edited the Shas, sometimes they'll make a statement, and then you'll assume that statement connects to the very next line in the Gemara, but sometimes the Gemara goes on to a sort of a
side note.
Yeah, not exactly a side note, but in this case, what the Gemara is going to do, it's going to take Rav's suffix and it's going to interpret it in one way, and only when we get to the second interpretation of Rava and his suffix, then we're going to make sense out of the sentence Milsa the Pshita Leil Abaye Miboy Leil Rava. So you take that sentence and you put it in a, like a koteret, you know, it becomes like a highlighted as the topic or the theme of our discussion, and then you're going to have one interpretation of Rava, and that's not going to help us for the Milsa the Pshita Leil Abaye Miboy Leil Rava, but rather the second interpretation, which is Mar Bar Avashi. Okay, Hopefully I wasn't confusing you. Dibay Rav. Okay. Now, Rav's Safek is based on what I told you before, which is the Suya Daf Mem Aleph Amin Beis, much later on, about the following. The onus took place when she was a Nara, and then before Hamadah, by the time we got to Hamadah Bedin, she was already a Bogeris. Okay? And Lechora, that has nothing to do with Abaye that we just saw. Because again, Abaye's Misa case is a case of a Misa while she was a Nara. So if you keep that in mind, it'll save you a lot of confusion. Again, I'll repeat it one more time. Abaye's discussion is about a case where she died during her state of Naros. This discussion that we're going to have in Rava is on a totally different plane, going down a whole different pathway. Rava now is going to talk about a case which might be similar to Abaye in one sense, because we're going to talk about Misa, but it's totally different than Abaye, because here the Misa took place at a much later period of time in her life, meaning after she became a Bogeris. So I'm assuming you didn't understand the word that I said, but that's okay, because I didn't understand it either. So let's go through Boy Rava. Boy Rava, Yesh Bagar Bekever, O Ein Bagar Bekever. It works like this. Rava is not talking about removing Knas. He's talking about removing the father's, again, in one side of his suffering, one possibility of Rava, is to remove the father from the Knas, which would mean that her son is going to inherit the Knas. What happened over here? So Rava looked at the sugya later on in Daf Mem Aleph Amud Beis, and there the Gemara establishes that if she becomes a Bogeris after Hamadah Bedin, then in such a case, she collects the Knas. Okay? Now we want to know what happens if we assume that after she died, let's say the onus happened, just for argument's sake, on her 12th birthday, right? As soon as she became a Nara, correct? Mm-hmm. Now she dies, and the Mahmudah Bedin takes place a half a year later. Now, you'll ask me, well, is she a Bogeris? Well, she's Nebuch gone, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a svara here, which has to be understood, called Yesh Bagar Bekever. That's one side in Rav's Safek, which means Yesh Bagar Bekever means that we consider her at the time of Hamadah Bedin to be a Bogeris. Mainaf Gemina, we remove the father. Because that's what the Gemara is going to tell us later on in Mem Aleph Amud Beis, that if the Hamadah Bedin takes place after she became a Bogeris, then the father is out. That doesn't mean the Knas is out, Rabosa. The Knas is very much alive. She'll collect the Knas. And in this case, where she died while she was a Nara, and now she became a Bogeris before the Hamadah Bedin, if you hold Yesh Bagar Bekever, then the Yerusha now of the Hassan is gonna take over the Knas. In other words, she, if she were alive, she would collect the Knas because she's a Bogeris, and if you hold the Yesh Bagar Bekever, she's a Bogeris. And now, since she's dead, then that collection will now transfer over to her heir, who's the son. Let's read it inside. Yesh Bagar Bekever, Ein Bagar Bekever. Do we consider her to be a Bogeris, even though she's dead? If you hold Yesh Bagar Bekever, then what's going to be with this Knas? Then Udibnahavi, her son will collect the Knas. Why? Because he comes first. This is called Haben Yorish, as Aviv, or as Ima in this case, before the father. So therefore, if the father wants to sue the Ma'anis for Knas, he cannot do so, because she's already a Bogeris, in inverted commas, you know what I mean? She's a Bogeris in the Kever. O Dilma, ain't Bagar Bekever, de Avia Havi. Now again, in both studim of Rav's Safek, there is a Knas. The only issue is who collects that knas. This is totally antithetical to Abaye. This is not what you call Bilsa the Pshitel Abaye Mibayle L'Rav. So this whole Gemara that we're learning now is sort of a Maira Muzgar. You know, it's a parenthetical. You know, you should sort of put brackets around it. Until finally the Gemara is going to reinterpret Rav's Suffolk in such a way that it depends upon Abaye. But Abaye held that the moment she dies, and she's an ar, the whole enterprise, the whole institution of Knas goes down the tubes. Right? For Lo Lavia Mesa means that the whole parsha of Ma'anis, as far as Knas is concerned, is completely dissolved. That's not what Rav is saying. Rav is vacillating back and forth after her death. If X number of months went by, such that by the time of Hamad Abedin, she would, if she were alive, she would be a Bogeres. Rav now vacillates back and forth. Who collects the knas? If we assume Yesh Baga Bekever, which means that she now is a Bogeres, so had she been alive, she would collect the knas. Now she bequeaths that right to collect the knas to her closest heir in Parshas Yerusha and Seder Anachlos, and that is going to be what? That's going to be her son. But if you hold Ein Baga Bekever, it means that, so to speak, the situation is frozen, as it were, at the time of her death. She remains a Nara, and therefore Davia Havi, the father, collects the knas. This is not Abaye. That's why I'm just pointing that out to you, because it took me a long time to figure that out. Because you see Milsa the Pshita Abaye mi Boy Leila Rava, and then you read Boy Rava, and you assume that's what the Gemara has in mind, but that's not what the Gemara has in mind. And Rashi points this out in two places. One Rashi is here was Shabbos. That's why I couldn't underline. Okay, so I'll show you the Rashi's a little bit later. I don't want to take the time right now, but we'll see it in two different Rashi repeats himself twice. Okay. Now we're going to take a long. How do you say, parenthetical, what's the word I'm looking for, digression. Mima Abra, how is it possible that this girl who died during her narus could have had a son?
How is that possible?
And not only that, she's a basula. Do you follow what's going on? We're really between a rock and a hard place, because if she's a ba'ula, let's say you'll tell me she was married as a katana, right? And therefore she already became pregnant as a katana. We'll see soon that the Gemara holds biologically that a katana, until she's 11 years old, could not possibly give birth and survive it, and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. So how did she reach knots? But
that's contrary to the...
We're going to have a lot of problems in biology. I don't know. I'm going to leave the biology for the end of the sugya. Right now, I just want to survive this sugya. So again, what's the issue over here? Again, if we're talking about knas, and according to Rav, both of his sons, there is a knas here, whether it's to the father or to the son, if you follow me. But there is knas, which means that she was a nara at the time of the onus. So if she became pregnant, we don't believe in what's her name? We mentioned over there, Emma, that's with a Y, right? With an immaculate cut. Right? So how could she possibly... So we would have to assume that she became pregnant as a Nara, and she gave birth during Naras because she died as a Nara.
Well, I have a question.
You know what I'm saying? What? So she would have had to... Let's say she became pregnant. Let's say the onus was on her birthday of 12... Yeah. Right? On her 12th birthday, which became a Nara. And let's say she had another relationship the next night, let's say, or maybe she became pregnant from that relationship, whatever it might be. And then she died within 6 months, but she left a son. So she would have to have a son who had a pregnancy period of less than 6 months, by definition. The Gemara is going to hold another biological thing. That's impossible. So that's what I'm telling you.
There's something I'm missing.
Yeah.
She got pregnant as a result of, say, the onus or the pituri, and for some reason the din wasn't until, say,
a long time,
like after she gave birth and then she died. Why couldn't we just say that?
That what?
That.
Say it again. When did she die?
She could, She died after giving birth, say...
No, but did she die as a Bogeres? Did she live to be a Bogeres? That's my question. If she lived to be a Bogeres...
Oh, then there's no question.
Then there's no question. Then Rob would have no question.
Thank you.
Why?
Thank you.
Because then, for sure, the moment she dies, it goes to our heir.
Yeah.
Then the father is definitely out of the picture.
Okay.
The only reason the father's not out of the picture is because she died as a Nara.
I thought by definition, once she's pregnant, she's no longer a Nara.
There's something called something Ein Simanim. I forgot what it's called. Yuladim Ein Simanim, but that's not exactly what I'm saying.
No, okay. All
right, let's just see if we can work it out biologically. Again, Rabbi Ossi, here's the challenge. This woman had an onus when she was a Pasula, and she's a Nara, and she gave birth to a son, but she died during Naras. I mean, again, that's what we have to juggle over here. Vatani, Rav Bibi, Kameda, the Rav Nachman. So, Rav Oso, what we're about to learn now is the sugya called contraception. Okay? And the issue is, again, I'm not talking about the pill, because the post can want to claim that the pill is radically different than what we're going to see now. The method of contraception here, which today would be considered primitive minus, you know, is to wipe herself off with what's called a moch, some sort of a sponge, that will absorb the sperm, the semen, in such a way that she won't get pregnant, correct?
Wait a minute.
And this is a serious issue in halacha, and we're going to try to figure out under what circumstances did the halacha permit this. So again, I'm going to say, I don't want you to walk away thinking here that the halacha is this only three cases because of a very pressing need are we going to allow contraception. That's not so. This method of contraception is very problematic.
But this is wiping after the fact?
After the
is
fact.
Is this not like a diaphragm?
No, it's okay. Not like a diaphragm.
Thank right? you.
So, Sholeth, Noshin, Mishamsh, Smoke, there are three cases or three categories of women where the pressing need that she should not get pregnant will allow us, will permit us to be matir using a moch. Because a moch, to some extent, again, I say to some extent, is called hashchas azera. Right? The zera is still alive and well, and she's trying to get rid of it and destroy it so that she won't become pregnant. And that's a problem of hashchas azera. So again, if you ask me in general, with the exception of these three cases, is a moch allowed to actively destroy the zera after the bia? The answer is no. It's not allowed. Again, what about other methods of contraception? Tzarech im. You know, if my Rebbe was alive, I would tell you, if you need a head, don't ask my Rebbe. Because I went through this with the Rebbe. Till finally, after asking him for months, he said, I think maybe you should ask somebody else. Finally, he told me to ask somebody else. Because he didn't want to tell me it's Osler, because he knew it was Osler, in his opinion. But he knew that all the other poskim would be matir. So. And I never forget, he made me take a shmur d'oraisa that I would tell him exactly who I went to and what the answer was. You know, that was all part of the deal. So when he said this, I held my tongue. I said, Rebbe, why didn't you tell me this like months ago? That you know what I'm saying? Anyway, so there are other methods of contraception, but this one is a real problem. But in three cases, we're going to allow. So what are the three cases? Number one is ketana. Right, so let's say her father married her off, or perhaps if her father's not alive, one of her other relatives, her mother, brother married her off, and she might get pregnant. So we're going to see later on that the Gemara assumes up until a certain age, let's say 11, up until that age, if she gets pregnant, she's going to die. And it's like mamish, like in the Gemara's mindset, it's vade that she's going to die. So we have to make sure that she uses contraception, and therefore we're going to allow moch. Number two, me'uberes. She's pregnant. We'll see exactly what that's all about. And then meiniko, she's nursing. So let's go through it. Ketana, why would we allow it in the case of a ketana? Shematis aver vitomus. That the rule of thumb, according to the biology of the Gemara, is that a ketana who gets pregnant and as a result she's going to die. Okay? And I'm going to read to you the footnote here in the Masifta, and he writes the following. Melamedes HaBraisa Shem Ketana Misaberes. Listen carefully. Hivadei Meso. pregnancy will kill a katan. V'lachem maksha ketzad yitochin shebino shel hanusa yirashosa. In other words, again, the whole question of the Gemara, how could it be that this Anusa could have a son, is based on the fact that there's no possibility for Mitzias, according to this Braisa, that she could have gotten pregnant as a Ketana and survived it. She just simply won't survive. And this is going to be really problematic, because there's a Sugin Yevamis which assumes that Shemitis Aber, and then after the word tis'aber, we have the word tomus, we have to add another word, v'shema tomus. In other words, it's a sex fake, because she may become pregnant, which is very likely, very hard statistics. And if she becomes pregnant, she might die. That's not the way our Gemara seems to learn it. And the Rishonim are stuck with what they see as a contradiction. Our Gemara assumes biologically there's no way she could have a son as a Nara, because if she became pregnant as a Katana,
oh, yeah,
then she would die. So she couldn't have survived this pregnancy. But in truth, the way the Gemara in Yevamah says it, it's Shematis Aber, V'imtis Aber Shematomos. But it's not a Vada. So there could be such a mitzvah that Rava was vacillating back and forth. Who collects the knas because she has a son? Because she became pregnant when she was a ketana. Again, we have to talk about how could she be a basula, and then we're going to have to assume, like the Chachamim of Rabbi Meir, that a ketana collects knas. Do you remember that whole discussion? Okay, fine. So Vitirtsu, the Rishonim one asked, Shekavadas HaGemara Shom Shi Tochin Shalom Tavus V'Oz Yisbar Shi Bogra Kodim Zman. That she prematurely became a Bogeris. But if there's no premature Bagrus here, and she's really a Ketana, then Erochinami Vade Tom. So again, if you were to take an exam here, and the question is true or false, Ketana Shenis Abra Vade Tom, true or false? The answer is true. The Gemara says maybe she'll die. The Gemara's talking about a case where she became a Bogeris when she was a Ketana. Exactly how that works, we have to figure out.
Wait a minute. The pregnancy, not the birth, is what will kill her.
The pregnancy is going to kill her.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Next, Mu'uberes. Why were they matir a Mu'uberes? Shema tase ubra sandal. Okay, now this again, I just, it was Shabbos, so I couldn't check Google, but I think this is not biologically correct. But the Gemara is working with its own biology, and that is that a pregnant woman can become pregnant. I don't know. Somebody told me that it once happened in history, that a pregnant woman became pregnant. In any event, what the Gemara is saying is that she may become pregnant while she's pregnant with a second fetus, and the second fetus is going to destroy the life of the first fetus. Also, Vlad Yidchok as a Vlad Arishon. And then as a result, the fetus itself is going to be marred. It's going to change its whole features. It'll probably come out as a stillborn. And the Gemara describes in very gory terms what that first fetus looks like as a result of the dochak of the second fetus. I don't know what we do with twins. Don't ask me a question from twins. And it's going to nimel a sandal. It's going to look like something called a sandal. Now, sandal in this context doesn't mean what it usually means, a shoe, but rather it means a fish. There's a certain fish that has a face that looks like a sandal. And in any event, it's going to die. So this is very interesting because, you know, in many cases, what we call Siamese twins cases and that, which is rare, but it happens, and it's documented. So there's an issue, are we allowed to take the life of one of the two to save the other? And he did Rodef. You know what I'm talking about? This is a famous tshuva, I think, of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and others got involved in this. It was a case that came up. So here, what we're saying is that since the first fetus exists as a viable fetus, then to go ahead and destroy that fetus, even for the sake of another fetus, that's not a question of rodent. That for sure would be a rodent, meaning, if you followed me. In other words, if you have two twins that are both alive, then it's very complicated to say which twin is the rodent. You know what I'm saying? In the case of Siamese twins, but in the case of a fetus, once the fetus is alive, we have to do everything that we can to keep that fetus alive. Then we have the third case of Meinika, Shematigmal es Binah. So this is fascinating, because what the Gemara is saying is that if a nursing woman becomes pregnant, then ye'acher ha'cholav shela, something happens to her milk, and she's not able to properly nurse her baby. You begin to see, and this is not the first time in this Masechta that you'll see this, it's over and over again, that nursing is critical. You know, today we have Materna, we have Dos, yes, you know, but it's very sophisticated today. But, and even today, I mean, every last doctor on the face of the earth will tell you, if all things are equal, there's nothing that could really substitute for mother's milk in so many different ways. But nevertheless, we have other ways. You know, it's not the end of the world if a woman can't nurse. But in the Gemara's time, that was considered like the end of the world. So there's a famous tshuva of Rav Henkin. You know, Rav Henkin was the final word in America before he died, up until his death, and then Rav Moshe Feinstein sort of became that took over that position. But Rav Henkin was of the opinion that contraception at the time of the Gemara, by definition, would last for 2 years, and maybe even 4 years, because the Gemara assumes that a mother nurses her baby for two to four years. And contraception means, in this case, to give all your attention to the baby that was born. So the mitzvah period of Arivia now takes a back seat in favor of raising the child. You already have a child, so now your responsibility is towards this child. And Rav Henkin was very, very makil. He was the big makil on contraception for a woman who gave birth. You know, when does she go back to her normal, situation? And the Gemara says that there was, although there's a sort of a built-in contraception by virtue of the fact that a woman is nursing, but no guarantees. But the period of time that a mother has to dedicate to her child is equivalent to when they had nursing and when it was natural for a woman to nurse. Yeah, just mentioning it in passing, we're not clear. Okay. Eze hiktana, that's when do we say that a girl is allowed to use a moch? And the Gemara's answer is, Mi bas achatesre v'yom echad, at shtemesre shonu v'yom echad. Ava pochus mikan, v'yeser al kan, v'shameshes kedarek av ha'olefes. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Okay, this is Rabbi Meir's shita. And according to Rabbi Meir, the danger period for her is between the age of 11 and 12. Why? Because if she's less than 11, or she's more than 12, mishamesh is kedarka. Why? Because if she's less than 11, she will not get pregnant. And if she's older than 12, then she'll be able to carry her birth, her carry to term without dying. So again, there are two reasons why, according to Rabbi Meir, less than 11 and beyond 12, there's no heter of moch. In the case of her youth before she gets to the age of 11, then she's not going to become pregnant. Again, I don't know the biology today, I don't think, but anyway, that's what he says. And if she's 12 years old and beyond, then she'll be able to carry to term. So the only time that there's a sakana here as a result of pregnancy, in the case of a katana, is between the age of 11 and 12. So that's Shita's Rabbi Meir. The Chacholim Omrim, Achas Zu, the Achas Zu, whether she's a katana who's 11, and even in the case where she's pregnant, and even in the case where she nurses, mishameshes kedarka v'olechus. We're not going to allow moch.
In which none of these three cases?
None of these three. And why? U'min ha'shamayim yirachemu. She's protected by the divine being. Mishum shenem ha'shomer p'soyim ha'shem. This is very, very complicated because we have a principle called Ein Somech L'Hanes, and we do whatever we can within the biological universe to protect human life. We don't say, well, God will take care of you. I mean, there is a religion that believes in that. You know, I don't know if you've heard about the Christian Scientists, but yeah. That's very antithetical to Judaism. I mean, Judaism is predicated on Rachel Yerape. You know, we have to investigate all possibilities. So this pasuk in Tehillim, Shomer Psoim Hashem, when does it apply? There was an original tumor of Moshe once applies to smoking. You know, keep in mind, you know, sometimes you have to see tumors in a historical context, because at the time of Moshe, you know, I'm talking when he wrote his first tumor, later on he changed his mind, but when he wrote his first tumor, everybody was smoking. I mean, every Rebbe in the yeshiva was smoking. I mean, I remember when I, at 18, I came to the yeshiva here in Israel when I was 19 years old, and there was a base medrash, and then you went up one flight to the Ezra's Noshim, and you opened the tris to look down. So during the week, there were no women there, so people learned to do this. When you opened the tris, you couldn't see anyone in the base medrash, which was a few feet below you. The whole place was covered with smoke. I mean, there was a guy in Yeshiva who made his parnasa by putting up a pack of cigarettes on the wall, and you had to put 10 agarot in the little pushka and take a cigarette. And this goes on in the base medrash. This went when I was 19 years old. So I'm not, you know, I'm not from the 20, you know, from the 19th century. I'm telling you what went on in my youth. So Moshe applied the principle, Shomer Psoim Hashem. You know, it's Shomer Psoim Hashem means if this is the natural way of living, then God will protect you. You don't have to stand on. So to Rabbi Moshe, smoking was natural. He himself, I don't think, was a smoker, but everyone else around him was smoking. My father was a chain smoker. I never saw my father in my life with a cigarette, because my father had open heart surgery, and his surgeon said, if I ever catch you with a cigarette, you know, because my father was a chain smoker, he said, if I ever catch you with a cigarette, find yourself another doctor. So I never saw my father with a cigarette. Like, to me, like, my father smoking a cigarette is like hard to even imagine. You know, I can't even imagine it, but. So when do you apply Shomer Psoim Hashem? Very complicated business, you know. Many tshuvas over the course of history that have been written on this one, three words in a pasuk in Tehillim, Shomer Psoim Hashem. Now, what is it all about? All right, we'll stop here. So I will say again, what we're left with, and I'm leaving you with a cliffhanger here, is we're not exactly sure yet how a girl could possibly get pregnant at the age of 11, you know, and have a viable child, and then still be a Nara, and she's still a Psula, and she has a son to inherit her. You know, so we'll have to work out the details tomorrow. Maybe I can just borrow your pencil for a split second. So again, keep in mind that Rabbi Meir will allow a use of Moch at the age of 11, because A, she could become pregnant at the age of 11, and B, she'll die as a result of pregnancy.